Dreadnought, Part 3, by Robert K. Massey. Continued. Cassette 3, Side 1. Eulenburg, overjoyed, replied, "You are our dear good sovereign's last card. No other can, and still less will, do all for him that you are doing. Another might have genius or erudition, but love and loyalty will always be lacking, the love of a faithful servant, which with you has taken the form of a father's love for a difficult child. How terribly alone the poor emperor stands." When Bülow was appointed imperial chancellor, Eulenburg congratulated him again. "One of the best things God has given me to do was my intervention in your career, an intervention which I always felt to be my mission. I am possessed by the sense that after terrible storms I have at last steered the ship we may call the Emperor's reign into at least a tolerably safe anchorage." With Bülow at the helm, Eulenburg's direct political influence diminished, which he said was his wish. He maintained his personal friendship with the Kaiser through the annual cruises to Norway and the hunting parties at Romantern and Liebenberg. His friendship with William became, if anything, more possessive. At Romantern, Eulenburg told Bülow, he had been appalled by the Empress's wrinkled, prematurely aged face and gray hair, and by the fact that all night long the Empress made scenes with her weeping and screaming. Eulenburg was deeply upset. "He told me with feverish agitation," said Bülow, "that the Empress was in such a nervous state that it would be very advisable if she were separated from the Kaiser soon." Donna remained, and Eulenburg's revulsion continued. 3 years later he complained that the Empress's love for His Majesty is like the passion of a cook for her sweetheart who shows signs of cooling off. "This method of forcing herself upon him is certainly not the way to keep the beloved's affections." Meanwhile, Eulenburg had begun to weary of official life. "10 years of uphill work for our dear master have completely exhausted me," he wrote to Bülow in 1898. The following year he broke with Holstein. Although in 1900 William elevated his old friend to the rank of prince, Eulenburg's fortunes were declining. His sweet, affected piety repulsed a diplomatic colleague. Eulenburg himself explained, "At a certain age, men go through a period of bodily change, just as women do." This was particularly true, he said, of men who in their sensitivity have a kind of feminine sensibility. In 1902, Eulenburg's mother died. Plagued by worries, heart disease, and gout, he departed Vienna after 8 years as ambassador and secluded himself at Liebenberg. Eulenburg continued to be invited to autumn hunts and on Norwegian cruises, but declined on the grounds of health. On Eulenburg's birthday, the Kaiser always visited Liebenberg. "As Philly will never come to me now," said William, "I have to come to him." In an exception to his normal seclusion, Eulenburg made the Norwegian cruise of 1903. He was ill throughout the voyage and found that his distaste for the holiday had grown. He described the Hohenzollern as this floating theater, where things were much as in the most frivolous lieutenant's mess. By 1905, Eulenburg seemed better. That autumn, the Russian Count Sergei Witte, returning home from negotiating the Russo-Japanese peace treaty at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, visited the Kaiser at Romantern. He found Eulenburg seated grandly like a monarch in a huge armchair, while William sat on the arm of the same chair, excitedly talking and gesticulating like a lieutenant. It seemed that Philip Eulenburg, the Kaiser's dearest friend, was resuming his role as a maker and breaker of men in Imperial Germany. Once Holstein had decided that it was Eulenburg who had brought him down, he burned for revenge. For years, through his spidery network of sources, he had made himself privy to police files on leading government figures. He was aware that in the 80s Philip Eulenburg's name had been included on the secret list of persons suspected of homosexual behavior. On May 1, 1906, Eulenburg received a letter from Holstein. It began with accusation. "My dear Philly," you needn't take this beginning as a compliment, since nowadays to call a man Philly means, well, nothing very flattering. You have now attained the object for which you have been intriguing for years, my retirement, and the general press attacks on me are also all that you can wish. In the letter, Holstein hurled an insult. I am now free to handle you as one handles such a contemptible person with your peculiarities. Eulenburg understood that Holstein meant to ruin him. Considering it a matter of life and death, Eulenburg decided that only a duel could clear his name. He challenged Holstein to exchange pistol shots until disablement or death. When he informed Tschitschke, the state secretary, imagining the scandal of two prominent elderly men formerly occupying the highest positions in the German Empire attempting to maim or kill each other, literally collapsed into his chair. "Withdraw the challenge, for God's sake and the Emperor's," Tschitschke begged Eulenburg. Eulenburg agreed to do so if Holstein would apologize. On May 3rd, Holstein wrote, "Prince Eulenburg, having assured me on his word of honor that he had neither hand, act, nor any part in my dismissal, and has in no way been concerned in any of the attacks on me in the press, I hereby withdraw the offensive remarks made upon him in my letter." Despite this retraction, Eulenburg, who once had likened Holstein to a bloodthirsty weasel, did not feel safe. "I cannot say that I consider Holstein's attacks really disposed of," he wrote. "He will revenge himself in his accustomed fashion." Holstein was already at work. He enlisted the aid of a man he had for years despised, Germany's most famous journalist, Maximilian Harden, founder and editor of the Berlin socialist weekly Die Zukunft, The Future. That summer and autumn, when a series of critical articles began to appear in Die Zukunft, Eulenburg understood that a new alliance had been formed. The articles blamed Germany's defeat at Algeciras on the sinister, pacifist influence of what Harden described as the Liebenberg Round Table, the group of friends who gathered every autumn with the Emperor at Prince von Eulenburg's Liebenberg estate. The group, Harden wrote sardonically, consisted of nothing but good people, musical, poetic, spiritualistic, so pious that they expect better cures from prayer than from the wisest doctor. In their intercourse, oral and written, they are of touching friendliness. This would all be their private affair if they did not belong to the Kaiser's closest round table, and from visible and invisible positions spin the threads which suffocate the German Empire. Harden described Eulenburg, the leader of the circle, as an unhealthy, late romantic and clairvoyant, who, with unflagging zeal, has whispered and whispers still to William II that he has chosen to rule alone. For years, Harden charged, no important post was filled without Eulenburg's help, and during this time he took care of all his friends. Harden had three reasons for attacking Eulenburg. He opposed the Kaiser's inclination toward personal rule, which he, rightly, believed was encouraged by Eulenburg. He had agreed with Holstein's policy of humiliating France and sundering the new Anglo-French Entente. When that policy was frustrated at Algeciras, Harden blamed Eulenburg for persuading the Kaiser to be conciliatory. Further, because of Eulenburg's close friendship with Raymond Lecomte, first secretary of the French embassy in Berlin, Harden suggested that Eulenburg was passing to Lecomte assurances that Germany was not prepared to back her diplomacy with threats of war. Harden's third reason was more personal and more poisonous. Lecomte, one of the German experts in the French Foreign Office, had known Eulenburg years before in Munich. Once assigned to Berlin, Lecomte was included in the annual Kaiserjagd at Liebenberg. Harden had evidence that Lecomte was homosexual. Adding this to rumors he had heard about Eulenburg, rumors now reinforced by information from Holstein's files, Harden created, first by innuendo, then by increasingly direct accusation, the image of a circle around Eulenburg which was at least homoerotic, if not openly homosexual. Harden was treading on dangerous ground. Homosexuality was officially repressed in Germany, as elsewhere in Europe. In the Reich, it was a criminal offense, punishable by prison, although the law was rarely invoked or enforced. Still, the very accusation could stir moral outrage and bring social ruin. This was especially true at the highest levels of society. In Austria, the Archduke Ludwig Victor, known as Luzi Woozy, brother of Emperor Franz Joseph, had an affair with a masseur and was sent into exile. In Germany, Fritz Krupp, head of the giant armaments firm and friend of the Kaiser, was accused of pedophilia on Capri, and amidst the scandal killed himself. A shadow had fallen close to Eulenburg in 1898 when his only brother, Friedrich von Eulenburg, a cavalry officer, was convicted of homosexuality and forced to resign from the army. The Kaiser, outraged, had demanded that Philip Eulenburg never see or speak to his brother again. A bitter Eulenburg told Bülow that he would not obey. Harden, by accusing Eulenburg and his Liebenberg circle, drew close to accusing the Kaiser himself. Philip Eulenburg had been William's closest friend for over 20 years. If the charge were true and the Emperor had not known, what did that suggest? Worse, what if the Emperor had known? Eulenburg asked Bülow how he should respond to Harden's attacks. The Chancellor, aware that Holstein's vendetta against Eulenburg sprang from the former First Counselor's belief that Eulenburg was responsible for the Kaiser's acceptance of his resignation, advised his friend to leave Germany for a while until things calmed down. Since his other friend, the Kaiser, who did not read Die Zukunft, treated him as warmly as before, Eulenburg did not heed the advice. In October, the Emperor joined his friends as usual at Liebenberg. In January 1907, he summoned Eulenburg to Berlin, where he invested his dear filly with the highest Prussian decoration, the Order of the Black Eagle. Harden waited until April 1907 before renewing his attack. In that month, he published an article specifically naming three of the Kaiser's military aides de camp, all members of the Liebenberg group, as homosexuals. The story astounded Berlin. Still, the Kaiser was oblivious. Eventually, when they were alone in the palace garden, Crown Prince William showed the Kaiser the Zukunft article and other press clippings. "Never shall I forget the pained and horrified face of my father, who stared at me in dismay," reported the Crown Prince. The moral purity of the Kaiser was such that he could hardly conceive the possibility of such aberrations. William reacted quickly. He demanded the immediate resignation of the three aides-de-camp and of Count Kuno von Moltke, military commander of Berlin, whom Harden had also implicated. Moltke had been the Kaiser's senior aide-de-camp for 8 years, 1894 to 1902. When William sent two bottles of old wine to Bismarck at Friedrichsruhe in 1894 as a conciliatory gesture, Moltke was the messenger. If Moltke was innocent, the Kaiser insisted that he immediately sue Harden for libel. As for Eulenburg, also included in Harden's attack, the Emperor wrote to Bülow, "I insist that Philip Eulenburg shall at once ask to be retired from the diplomatic service. If this accusation against him of unnatural vice be unfounded, let him give me a plain declaration to that effect and take immediate steps against Harden. If not, then I expect him to return the Order of the Black Eagle and avoid scandal by forthwith leaving the country and going to reside abroad." Eulenburg resigned immediately and sent back his Black Eagle. To Bülow, whom Eulenburg still considered a friend, he wrote, "The loss of an old imperial friendship was not the cruel deception which perhaps you expected it to be, since I know only too well the character of this pilot who shouts abandon ship in every case long before it is necessary." As to Harden's accusation, he said, "I know myself to be entirely innocent." Bülow, in his memoirs, claimed that at this stage he believed Eulenburg. "I was convinced that the accusations of unnatural practices brought against him were unfounded. His affectionate relations with wife and children, the deep and passionate love with which his charming and distinguished wife still clung to him, made such vile assertions appear monstrous." Obeying the imperial command, Moltke and Eulenburg moved to sue Hardin for libel. As both had been government officials, they asked the Prussian Crown Prosecutor to take the case. He refused, claiming that the matter was personal. Eulenburg then withdrew, but Moltke persevered. Hardin's trial began in Berlin Municipal Court on October 23, 1907. The editor was represented by Max Bernstein, Crown Prosecutor of Bavaria, acting in a private capacity. Bernstein immediately seized the offensive, attempting to implicate both Moltke and Eulenburg in the unquestioned activities of the three aides-de-camp. Disgusting orgies involving soldiers of the elite Garde du Corps regiment at the home of one of the incriminated aides were described. One witness thought he recognized Count Moltke as one of those present. Another witness testified that he had been debauched 10 years before by a man who might have been Count Eulenburg. Moltke's former wife declared that Eulenburg had gone down on his knees before her, begging that she give up her husband. Hardin, who had been an actor before he became an editor, played his role with flair. At one point, the judge begged him, in the interests of our whole country, to compromise. Hardin melodramatically leveled his finger at Moltke across the courtroom and shouted, "Between that man and me, there is no possibility of compromise on this earth." Bernstein scored his most damaging point when he emphasized that the emperor had demanded Moltke's and Eulenburg's resignations, and that both had immediately complied. Hardin was acquitted and walked out of the courtroom into a street filled with cheering people. During the trial, Bülow privately continued to pose as the sympathetic friend and confidant of the embattled Eulenburg. In fact, the chancellor and the government remained deliberately aloof. "In these painful circumstances," Bülow wrote the Kaiser, "we must see that the crown is kept completely removed from all connection with the affair." Eulenburg always assumed that the friend whom he had enthusiastically supported remained a friend. During the Hardin Moltke trial, Eulenburg repeatedly wrote to the chancellor, "begging me," said Bülow, "to see that his name did not appear, to use all my influence to keep him out of the case. I ask for your protection and friendship," Bülow quoted Eulenburg. "I do not beg for myself, but for my wife and children. Stand by me, if only for their sakes. I know myself entirely innocent." Bülow received these appeals coldly, writing in his memoirs, "As the highest official in the empire, I could not interfere with the action of an independent judiciary." Immediately after the Moltke-Hardin trial, Bülow himself was accused of homosexuality by Adolf Brandt, a journalistic crusader for homosexual rights. The Crown Prosecutor, who had refused to undertake libel cases on behalf of Moltke and Eulenburg, quickly took up the case on behalf of the Imperial Chancellor. Eulenburg, cited as a witness, appeared on Bülow's behalf. Bülow's name was rapidly cleared, and Brandt was sentenced to 18 months in prison. During the trial, Bülow testified that he considered the practices in question loathsome in the highest degree and quite incomprehensible. Hardin's triumph was brief. On December 19th, the government overturned the municipal court verdict on a technicality and ordered a new trial. This time, Eulenburg was summoned, and under oath, testified that he had never violated paragraph 175, prohibiting anal intercourse, of the criminal code. Pressed by Bernstein as to whether he had engaged in other homosexual acts, Eulenburg declared, "I have never done anything dirty. I have never practiced any abominations." Moltke's former wife was proven a liar, and the testimony of other witnesses in the first trial was discredited. The second trial ended on January 3, 1908, and Hardin, found guilty of libel, was sentenced to prison. Moltke, presumably vindicated but socially ruined, retired to his country estate. Hardin, free on appeal and foiled by Moltke, redoubled his attack on Eulenburg. Eulenburg had testified under oath that he was not homosexual. If Hardin could prove that he was, Eulenburg would be guilty of perjury. In April 1908, Hardin opened a new case in Munich, promising evidence of Eulenburg's flagrant homosexual behavior when he was in the Bavarian capital 25 years before. On May 8th, Bülow intervened. He ordered his old friend arrested and charged with perjury. The case was transferred to Berlin. Eulenburg, who suffered from heart trouble and severe rheumatoid arthritis, was ill, and his doctors pleaded that he not be held in prison. A compromise was reached, and the prince was incarcerated for 5 months in Berlin's charity hospital. When the trial began on June 29th, the defendant was carried into court every day on a stretcher. In preparation for the trial, Hardin and Bernstein assembled 145 witnesses against Prince Eulenburg. One by one, thieves, blackmailers, mentally ill persons, and homosexuals, each was brought into Eulenburg's hospital room to stare at the prince for identification. Before the trial began, most had been dismissed. 12 remained. During the first week of court proceedings, the 12 were reduced to 2. One of these had 32 previous convictions, running from bribery to indecent exposure. He was disqualified when it was learned that even after the trial had begun, he had tried to blackmail Prince Eulenburg. This left only Jakob Ernst. Ernst's connection with Eulenburg went back 25 years, to the early 1880s. While serving in Munich, Eulenburg had taken a villa on Lake Starnberg, between the city and the Alps. He liked to compose music and poetry while fishing on the lake. His regular boatman on these excursions was a 17-year-old boy, Jakob Ernst. Eulenburg employed Ernst, who seemed to him simple and innocent, as a house servant and took him along on trips. When Ernst married, he was put in charge of the Starnberg villa. 25 years later, at the time of the trial, Ernst had fathered 8 children, was partially deaf, and was addicted to alcohol. Before any legal proceedings had begun, when rumors of homosexuality were at first whispered, Ernst, unaware of his future involvement, had written to Eulenburg. "Would you ever have believed, my lord prince, that any people in this world could behave like that to such a good man as you are? I couldn't. I have known you for a long time, my lord prince. You have never shown me or my family anything but kindness, and never been the slightest trouble to any of us. Don't be afraid. It will be all right. I made someone explain the paragraph to me. It is simply shocking to say such things about you. Such a normal, healthy man as you are. I will close now, hoping you will get the better of the scandal." In the Munich trial, Ernst had sworn that he had never had indecent relations with Eulenburg. In Berlin, when Bernstein cross-examined him, threatened him with confrontation by a witness, with conviction of perjury, and with speedy removal to prison, Ernst changed his story. On one occasion in 1883, he said, Eulenburg had made advances to him in a boat, and he had accepted. Bernstein also produced a letter from Eulenburg to Ernst, written after Ernst had first appeared before the court in Munich. "Besides," Eulenburg had written, "if anything of the kind ever had taken place, it was such an old story that there could no longer be any question of punishment." Bernstein described this as an admission of guilt. Eulenburg explained it as an attempt to calm and reassure a terrified former servant. Bernstein's case hinged entirely on Ernst. "Hardin sent 145 printed accusations into court against me," Eulenburg wrote to Bülow. "Of these, all of which were exposed for the lies they were, one was enough to ruin me." The trial was never completed. Before Princess von Eulenburg could present her testimony, "In the long period of 34 years comprising our married life, I have never perceived the smallest sign of anything but a perfectly normal emotional life or manner of life." Philip Eulenburg fainted in court. His leg was badly swollen. Doctors diagnosed thrombosis and refused to allow him to return to court. The court moved to charity hospital. Eulenburg's health worsened and the trial was adjourned. In September, he was no better and the case was suspended. The following summer, 1909, the trial resumed, Eulenburg collapsed again, and the case was postponed indefinitely. Bülow, by August 1909, was no longer in power. In writing to him, Eulenburg, still unaware of the former chancellor's role in Holstein's downfall, allowed himself only a mild reproach for Bülow's behavior. Only one thing seemed difficult to explain. The fact that neither the official nor even the semi-official press cared to take up the cudgels on behalf of one of the highest German functionaries and fight scandal and scandal-mongering newspapers. From Rome, where he lived in retirement, Bülow oozed condolence. "My dear Philly, for many years we lived on the closest terms of friendship. How could I, therefore, ever be indifferent to your misfortune? All I could do within the limits of my duty as chancellor, I did, to prevent those deeply tragic events which, as a man, cut me also to the heart. I did whatever was in my power to make your position somewhat easier." In writing his memoirs, Bülow appeared to make up his mind about Eulenburg. His friend, he said, was a man of abnormal instincts, perilous inclination, and lack of erotic integrity. The fate of poor Philly, he said, suggested an obvious comparison with both the fate and the abnormal inclination of Oscar Wilde. Eulenburg lived at Liebenberg in seclusion until his death in 1921. From time to time, during these 12 years, court-appointed doctors burst in on him unexpectedly to see whether he was strong enough to return to court. Always their verdict was, "Prince Eulenburg is not fit to stand trial." The scandal horrified the Kaiser, but William missed his friends. In October 1907, as the first Moltke-Harden trial was beginning, William suffered a nervous collapse and went to bed for 2 days. At Christmas that year, he wrote to Houston Stewart Chamberlain, "It has been a very difficult year which has caused me an infinite amount of worry. A trusted group of friends was suddenly broken up through insolence, slander, and lying. To have to see the names of one's friends dragged through all the gutters of Europe without being able or entitled to help is terrible." William never saw Philip Eulenburg again, although from time to time he was heard to sigh, "Poor Philly." In 1927, 9 years after his abdication and flight to Holland, ex-Kaiser William II wrote to Eulenburg's son that he believed Philip Eulenburg had been absolutely innocent. Chapter 37. The Daily Telegraph Interview. At the end of October 1907, as the first Moltke-Harden trial was beginning in Berlin, the Kaiser, ordinarily eager to travel, especially to England, faced an English trip he dreaded. William had been shocked and infuriated by the alleged actions of his intimate friends, and was mortified that these charges had been published in newspapers throughout the world. What were the English thinking? What must his English relatives be saying about him behind his back? The questions were urgent because he and the Empress Augusta were about to set out on a state visit to Great Britain. The trip, scheduled to begin November 11th, had been planned months in advance. In June, William had written to his uncle, King Edward VII, that he looked forward to seeing Windsor Castle and to good sport in the dear old park I know so well. Then, on October 31st, William telephoned Chancellor von Bülow to say that he had had an accident. An attack of giddiness had forced him to stretch out on a sofa. There he had fainted and rolled onto the floor. "My head hit the ground so hard that my wife was alarmed by the noise and came rushing to me, terrified," he told Bülow. Because of this, he continued, he could not possibly think of undertaking the exhausting trip to England. Already he had wired this news to King Edward. In fact, the telegram to the king described the illness differently. "Bronchitis and acute cough. A virulent attack of influenza. I feel quite unable to meet the strain of the program so kindly prepared for me." The king was furious. "I cannot say how upset I am," he told Knowles. Sir Edward Grey immediately telegraphed Sir Frank Lassels, the British ambassador in Berlin, that "there is little doubt that this decision would be attributed to the recent scandals in Berlin, and nothing that we could say or do would alter the impression." Lassels delivered this message to the Chancellor and added, "The worst of it is that about an hour ago I was in the Tiergarten and met the Emperor, who is alleged to be so seriously ill, galloping along with a group of his aides in very good spirits. In his memoirs, Bülow said bluntly that William was too embarrassed to go to England. After seeing Lassels, the Chancellor sent a sharp note to the Kaiser. William immediately changed his mind. He invited the Chancellor to join him that evening at the theater, where he informed Bülow that his indisposition had disappeared. He had taken a refreshing gallop, eaten a hearty meal, and now was ready to go wherever the Chancellor wished. Bülow informed Lassels that the Kaiser would be coming to England as planned. On November 11th, an unusually thick fog hung over the Channel in southern England. As the Hohenzollern approached Portsmouth, reported the Times, the German squadron and the Admiralty were practically engaged in a game of hide-and-seek. Later that day, when the German party reached Windsor Castle, the fog was so thick that from a window in St. George's Hall it was impossible to see across the quadrangle as the state carriages arrived through the royal entrance. William, wearing his British Admiral's uniform, nevertheless was ebullient. "It seems like coming home again to Windsor," he told the mayor. "I'm always glad to be here." At a state banquet for 180 guests the following night, King Edward inserted a mischievous dig into his formal welcome. "For a long time we had hoped to receive this visit, but recently we feared that, owing to indisposition, it would not take place. Fortunately, their majesties are now both looking in such good health that I can only hope their stay in England will much benefit them." The visit's public climax was a reception in London. Sunshine and breeze and cloud-flecked blue sky, more reminiscent of April than November, greeted the Kaiser as he drove through cheering crowds and waving banners from Paddington Station to the Guildhall. One large banner, "Blut ist dicker als Wasser," "blood is thicker than water," touched him especially, and he added the expression to his speech later that morning. His address to the Lord Mayor referred to his first visit as Emperor in 1891, when he had been given the freedom of the city. 16 years ago, I said that my aim was above all the maintenance of peace. History, I venture to hope, will do me the justice that I have pursued this aim unswervingly ever since. The main support and base for the peace of the world is the maintenance of good relations between our two countries, and I shall further strengthen them as far as lies within my power. Blood is thicker than water. The German nation's wishes coincide with mine. Haldane, whose German was fluent, was called upon for extra duty, as some of the German guests did not speak English. One day he escorted General Karl von Einem, the Prussian war minister, and other members of the Kaiser's party to London, where he showed them the war office and invited them to lunch at his house in Queen Anne's Gate. Afterwards, he noted, they wished to visit not the Tower of London or Westminster Abbey, but Herod's. Einem had special reason to be grateful to Haldane. After the Windsor Castle banquet, when the gentlemen were sitting in the smoking room with the King and the Kaiser, Haldane, next to General von Einem, noticed that he was in pain. "I tracked the source of his discomfort to his feet. His pumps were too tight across the instep." As soon as the two sovereigns left, I turned to the war minister and said it was the custom of Windsor Castle, as soon as royalty left, to kick off our shoes, and I set the example. He looked at me gratefully. It was understood before the visit that political issues would not be discussed at Windsor. The Kaiser, however, was incapable of compartmentalizing his conversation, and while talking to Haldane, brought up the matter of the Berlin to Baghdad railway. Germany had obtained a concession from the Sultan to build the Turkish section of the new line. The project was delayed by British concern that the railroad would open a potentially hostile approach to India through the Persian Gulf. "What did England want?" William asked. "I said I knew we wanted a gate to protect India from troops coming down the new railway." The gate was control of the final section which would reach the Gulf. "I will give you the gate," William replied. That night, during the theatrical performance which followed dinner, Haldane sat behind the Kaiser. Leaning forward, he asked William whether he was serious about giving us a gate. Next morning, a helmeted Prussian guardsman, one of those the Emperor had brought with him, knocked loudly on my door and handed me a message from the Emperor that he had meant what he said. That evening, the Kaiser invited Haldane to his apartment after the theatricals. Haldane went at 1 in the morning and discovered William talking and smoking with Baron Wilhelm von Schön, the State Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Einem, and Metternich. Haldane bowed and began to withdraw, saying, "I feel myself an intruder, because it is like being at a meeting of Your Majesty's Cabinet," he said. "Be a member of my Cabinet. I appoint you," William responded. At 3 a.m., Haldane left the Kaiser's apartments and groped his way down dark passageways back to his own room in a different part of the castle. Politicians in both countries were pleased by the visit. "I wish to express my satisfaction at the welcome of the imperial couple by the king and people," Bülow told the Reichstag. "I believe that when the history of the last decade is written, it will appear that the tension between England and Germany, which has long oppressed the world, was due in the last resort to a great mutual misunderstanding. Each attributed to the other purposes that it did not entertain. I am certain that I speak for this house and the German people when I say that such peaceful and friendly feelings are shared by us." Sir Edward Grey agreed. "It is bound to have a good effect." Morley hoped that the visit of the German Emperor will much improve the chances of a little decent calm in Europe. Escher, writing in his journal, introduced a discordant note. "Our king makes a better show than William II. He has more graciousness and dignity. William is ungrateful, nervous, and plain. Grey had 2 long talks with him. At the first he declaimed violently against Jews. There are far too many of them in my country. They want stamping out. If I did not restrain my people, there would be Jew-baiting." The state visit lasted a week. At the end, the Empress Augusta returned to Germany. William, delighted by his enthusiastic reception, so different from the murky atmosphere of Berlin, decided to prolong his stay on a private basis. He rented Highcliffe Castle near Bournemouth in Hampshire, and invited the owner, Colonel Edward Montagu Stuart Wortley, a regular army officer, to stay on as his guest. William delighted in these surroundings. "The great British people received me with warmth and open arms. During my stay I sampled, as I had long wanted to do, all the delights of English home and country life. Comfortable affluence, excellent people in all walks of life, with all classes giving clear evidence of culture in their elegance and cleanliness. Pleasant intercourse between gentlemen on an equal footing without all the ceremonial of royalty. I found it immensely refreshing and soothing." During this happy sojourn on the British coast, William talked freely to Colonel Stuart Wortley about his desire for England's friendship and his frustration that England constantly misunderstood and rejected his good intentions. Stuart Wortley took careful notes. During the week in October 1908, in which Austria precipitated an international crisis by annexing Bosnia and Herzegovina, Bernhard von Bülow was at his seaside villa on Norderney, a Frisian island on the North Sea coast. Overwhelmed with work, absorbed from morning to night in these difficult problems, Bülow received from the Kaiser, who was at Romintern, a bulky, almost illegible manuscript written on bad typing paper, with a covering letter asking if I saw any objection to its publication. The manuscript, written in English, was the draft of an extended interview with Kaiser William II on the subject of Anglo-German relations. Using remarks William had made during his 3 weeks at Highcliffe the previous autumn, Colonel Stuart Wortley was asking permission to publish the interview in the London Daily Telegraph. In Stuart Wortley's view, if the English public knew the extent of the Kaiser's Anglophilia, relations between the two countries would greatly improve. The Kaiser, too, wished for publication, but in accordance with the German Constitution, was asking the Chancellor's advice and approval. William demanded only that Bülow on no account forward it to the Foreign Office in Berlin. Bülow ignored the Kaiser. Without the slightest suspicion in my mind of the ominous contents of the manuscript, which I could not find the time to read, I sent it off to the Wilhelmstrasse with a note. Please read the enclosed article carefully, transcribe it in clear official script, duplicate it, and enter in the margin such corrections, additions, or deletions as may seem suitable. State Secretary Schön was absent from No. 76 Wilhelmstrasse when the manuscript arrived. Accordingly, it went to Understate Secretary Stemmrich, who read the draft and forwarded it untouched to Reinhold Clement, for the previous 12 years a counselor in the political division. Clement interpreted Bülow's instructions literally. He was to correct any errors of fact and not to express an opinion as to the advisability of publication. He made 2 minor corrections and returned the manuscript, now written neatly on good paper, to the chancellor. Bülow stated he again did not read the interview. He sent it back to the Kaiser, saying that he saw no reason not to publish. William sent it to Stuart Wortley, who gave it to the Daily Telegraph. On the morning of October 29th, Bülow found on his desk a long message from the Wolff Telegraph Agency office in London, summarizing an interview with the German Emperor published the previous day in the Daily Telegraph. In the interview, given to an anonymous person of unimpeachable authority, the Kaiser protested that he had always been a friend of England, but that his friendship was unappreciated. "You English are mad, mad as March hares," he said. "What on earth has come over you that you should harbor such suspicions against us, suspicions so unworthy of a great nation?" "He took as a personal insult," William continued, "the distortions and misinterpretations of the British press in describing his repeated offers of friendship with England. This hostility made his own effort to promote friendship all the more difficult, as the majority of Germans dislike the English." Then came what Bülow, in his memoirs, was to call the 3 enormities. When the Boer War was at its height, Russia and France had urged him to save the Boer republics by joining a continental coalition which would humiliate England to the dust. He had refused, the Kaiser declared, and had informed the Russians and the French that Germany would use her armed might to prevent such concerted action. He had sent this letter to his grandmother, Queen Victoria, and it had been placed in the archives of Windsor Castle. "Nor was that all," the Kaiser continued. "Just at the time of your Black Week, early in the Boer War, when disasters followed one another in rapid succession, I worked out what I considered to be the best plan of campaign, submitted it to my general staff, then dispatched it to England. That paper is likewise among the state papers at Windsor Castle, awaiting the severely impartial verdict of history. And as a matter of curious coincidence, let me add that the plan which I formulated ran very much on the same lines as that which was actually adopted by Lord Roberts." "But you will say, what of the German navy? Against whom but England is it being steadily built up?" "Its purpose," William explained, "was to protect Germany's growing worldwide trade." "Germany looks ahead. Her horizons stretch far away. She must be prepared for any eventualities in the Far East. Look at the accomplished rise of Japan. It may even be that England herself will be glad that Germany has a fleet." Bülow's reaction was utter dismay. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.